comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show. Whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this beautiful place we call Earth, thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. It is talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. You know, last night on during the show, you need to know, if you don't know this, well, I don't know that you need to know, but here goes anyway. If you're listening to the show via radio or internet or your cell phone or AM, FM, shortwave, if you're listening via any of those methods, during the break, when we take a break, we play music. Now, some of our affiliate stations will play some commercial spots during that time, but we play music. On our TV channel, we have something else going on. So during the one of the breaks last night on the TV channel, I played a video that featured the music of a beautiful young lady from Thailand, a singer. Her name is Oratai. And then after the show, I got an email from one of the people who was watching asking if that's my wife. Because you see, my wife used to be a professional singer in Thailand. And so the answer to that is no, that's not my wife. However, they do look a lot alike. And I, in a telephone conversation with my wife today, I told her about that email and she sort of chuckled. And said she went to get a new ID card, and the guy at the ID office, government office, asked her if she was Oratai's sister. They do look a lot alike, but that's not my wife. If you have not yet subscribed, you need to the K-Files. That's our free weekly newsletter. Free is a good thing, don't you think, especially in today's economy? It really is free. It's not one of those Washington, D.C. frees, you know, where we're going to give you something, but it's got, you know, 40 billion or trillion strings attached. It's not that. It's just free, real free, okay? So if you're not a subscriber to our free weekly newsletter, go to my website, KevinSmithShow.com, click where it says K-Files, and subscribe. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. Sometimes we think because something happened a long time ago, it has lost its value to us in the current world. That's really, it is true in some cases. But in many cases, it's unfortunate that we think that because there is value, a lot of value, in some of the things that have happened in the past. We're going to be talking about a man from our fairly recent past. We're going to be talking about George Adamski. George Adamski was one of the early contactees. And he had some pretty important stuff to tell us. We'll be back right after this.
Come on.
Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I mentioned just before break that one of the people from our fairly recent past who has really should have quite an impact upon ufology today is George Adamski. Like every person who has said that they have been in contact with extraterrestrials, George Adamski had his followers and his detractors, and that's no different today. There are followers and there are detractors. No one, and most especially our guest tonight, is demanding that you believe anything, but only that you examine evidence and let the evidence lead where it leads. My guest is Glenn Steckling when it comes to George Adamski and all things pertaining to George Adamski. Glenn Steckling is probably the authority on it, and he's been my guest before. I'm delighted he's back with us tonight. So, Glenn, welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Well, Kevin, thank you very much. It's good to be with you. It's been a while, and it's a pleasure to be back.
Glenn, let's just go ahead and start out by sharing with the audience the name of the organization that you head and the name of your website, because we have new listeners all the time. Since you've been with us last time, we have added probably tens of thousands of new listeners. So the name of your website and your organization, please.
Yes, it's very simple. It's the Adamski Foundation, all one word, .com. And we are the George Adamski Foundation that was established right after George Adamski passed away in April of 1965. And we have been in continuum operating to promote the materials and films and photographs in a worldwide forum in order to keep people aware and to help promote and educate them into this very real and substantive field.
Okay, now let's also start with why George Adamski? What is it about Adamski that has motivated you and your father before you, I believe, right?
That's correct.
What is it about Adamski that has motivated you to sort of pick up the torch here with the George Adamski information, and we'll, I'll just, for shorthand, we'll say the George Adamski case. What is it that motivated you to pick up the torch and run with it?
Well, I believe that personal experience is a huge qualifier when you have the opportunity to meet the man, know the man, spend time with the man. Our family was intimately involved with George after we had a sighting over downtown Washington, D.C. in 1963, and George came out to the East Coast thereafter. And we spent a great deal of time with him. Not only did he spend time in our house, we spent time with him in the Rotover residence out in Silver Springs, Maryland. My parents helped to organize radio and television and news press conferences for him on the East Coast. And we spent a huge amount of interactive time directly involved face-to-face with him and some of his contacts in the current situation of how this field was evolving, where it had come from, what were the expectations, and the direction that it was going. So, to speak from personal experience gives one the foundation to be much more assured about what you're talking about. It's not second, third-hand information. It's not passed down from somebody else. To be there and experience it is quite an amazing situation.
So you met George Adamski. You yourself have met him personally.
I spend many hours with him. when my parents were out taking care of assignments in order to get things done when he came into Washington, I spent hours and hours and often days sometimes with him in his company. He looked out for me, and he still conducted contacts in business that came to the house in the interim, and we spent a great deal of time. I was a young man of a child at that time, but when you have these type of experiences and you have the collateral foundation of them being repeated during later parts in life, then there is no doubt left. You've been there, you've done that, you've seen it with your own eyes, you've experienced it with your own sensations. So I can say that he was a most unique and most forthright and very truthful individual.
The detractors of Adamski, of course, and look, folks, absolutely everyone, regardless of whether you're talking about UFOs or anything else, any topic, anyone that stands up and makes a statement in this world has detractors. And if you don't think so, go post a video on YouTube, any video, and you'll find out you have detractors. And you'll be surprised and amazed and wonder, where do these people come from? What rock did they crawl out from under? But anyway, some of the detractors of Adamski focused on him, it seems, I mean, when you read what they write about, it seems that they focused on him because of his claim, number one, to have had face-to-face contact with people from another planet, and number two, because of his claim to have been on board their ships and to have been taken out, if you will, for a ride in space. So let's talk about that a little bit. He's one of the very early people to make the claim that he had face-to-face contact with someone from another planet. And the other planet, I believe, was Venus, right?
Well, let's be honest here. Let us go back historically. I think if we want to look historically in just recent records, I think the first person to claim that was Ezekiel, wasn't it?
But well, I didn't say he was the first. I said he's one of the early.
I'm sure that every culture has had their, and they have legends, and they have records, historical records, all over the world from every ancient culture of having face-to-face interaction. But let us focus here on George for a minute. He was considered to be the pioneer in this field, and in fact, many have referred to him as the ambassador to space. And the question is asked, like you asked, why George? Well, anybody can make that question. Why me? Why you? Why that person over there? And so on and so forth. It has to be somebody. And I think George was uniquely qualified and susceptible and willing to make these contacts in an unfearful way, in a non-aggressive way, and to encourage the benefits of these interactions and to go, which took great courage. I mean, there was a great, huge amount of resistance, a huge amount of, as you say, the distractors and skepticism. And let's face it, skepticism is important. We have to hold people accountable to what they say. And I feel in this field right now, there's very little of that. But he had to go out into the public, and in order to make these films and photographs available, he spoke before the government, theological institutions, military officials, and so on and so forth. It was not an easy task. His books were translated into a number of languages, oftentimes which were given without contract and without copyright or a monetary gain. They were done free of charge and given for publishing. So, as we said before, there's a huge amount of distractors, but they're using the same old arguments that have been already successfully peeled away and explained. But they continue to reverberate because we have now, you know, the news media, or rather the internet media, in which the information can be assimilated very, very quickly or instantaneously. And so we see the cascading of old arguments over and over again, and it takes a little work to go find out where they are successfully explained.
Okay, but the question is that the people that he had contact with from another planet, he said, were from Venus, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's what they told him they came for. When he had the first contact in Desert Center out here on Highway 10 and 177 between California and Phoenix and going towards Parker, Arizona, he and six witnesses over there witnessed a craft flying overhead over the Coxcomb Mountains. And interestingly enough, if you go on the website, you will find that the military that day in a Lockheed B-50 doing exercises out of the Salton Sea also reported a UFO sighting, which was recorded in Project Blue Book, which was the Air Force's official report and investigation at that time, and that was on the same day at the same time. And there were other witnesses in Desert Center as well that have come forth and said that they had seen collateral types of ships as well. So basically this ship landed, and he, along with six other witnesses, were alongside the road. He walked up towards this, a person came walking towards him, and they started to have a conversation in the sand by, you know, waving your hand to the sand, flattening it out, and then pictorially asking, this is the solar system, I'm here on the third planet, where do you come from, and so on and so forth. And so that's where the indication of this visitor came from. Now we understand that there's a great deal of present time controversy about whether our planets are inhabited or not, or can sustain life. And I ask your listeners to remind them that our old preconceptions about what existed on the moon and what existed on Mars slowly peels away further and further. And each time we go, we admit more information and more susceptibility towards life. And we can discuss this later, because I have report upon report of information that is pertinent to each one of those places.
So, well, you know, I did a show last year, a couple of shows, where we took photographs, NASA photographs, of Venus and simply zoomed in and took a look around. And I got to tell you, in fact, I wrote a book about it. It's available on my website. It's called Venus, Watch the Other Hand. When you zoom in on Venus using the NASA photographs, and you just zoom in, you see what looks for all the world like major complexes on Venus. And
I've not had that experience of doing that. I know many of telescope enthusiasts have trained their machines on many of the planets, including the moon, for extended period of times. Now through technology, they're able to uplink that through the television screens and what have you, and then, you know, just record for extended period of time, and then they have the opportunity sometimes to see movement of what we would call UFOs in between our atmosphere and there and in space and what have you. As far as what is reported on Venus, according to our official agencies, it has a very thick cloud cover, and then it's considered to be our sister planet. In fact, a recent release here just in the last couple months talked about how Venus is considered to be our sister planet in many different regards. And then we have to look at the discontinuity between the what is told to be the 800 degree temperature and the 600 mile an hour wind and the atmosphere is six times denser than boiling oil. And then we admit, and the Russians admit, that we go and we land space probes with parachutes on the surface. And the logical mind, a rational mind, would have to ask, how do you soft land anything under those temperatures and thermal updrafts and those cross collateral winds? And then you have to think about it, too. Why do we see radar images of jagged peaks and jagged mountain ridges under that type of a sandblasting environment 24/7 of 800 degrees, 600 miles an hour? That planet would be as smooth as a marble on the surface, geologically, geophysically. So we are responsible for rationalizing information that comes across and thinking about it. We become too used to people making our minds up for us. We get too used to getting a pre-canned answer and just simply say, oh, well, it doesn't pertain to me. It's not relevant to my current existence or my everyday life and struggles, in which to some degree it isn't. And so then we put it on the back burner and we don't think twice about it. But it is important to recognize one definitive. When these craft came to us in the 40s and 50s, our government was willing to go public, and in 52, after the massive sightings over Washington and the F-86s being scrambled and these things being tracked at high-speed maneuvers by the radar tower, Washington National, and so on and so forth, that they were willing to go public, and at the very end, there was a stop put onto it, actually, by General Hoyt Vandenberg. And from that time forward, there was an aura of deniability and also of let's just not talk about it. So basically, if we look at this, there was first an attitude of let's ignore it, it doesn't exist. And if it doesn't exist, then how in the world can we evolve into a space program that will go into outer space and then tell people where there's life out there? Because the first question they would say, well, if there's life out there, how the things that you told us that didn't exist before obviously did. So deniability on one phase has to be followed by deniability in the later phase, because both support each other.
Well, yeah, that's true. Once you tell a lie, the only way to keep it keep that lie in play is to keep fueling it with more lies.
Correct.
And, you know, the conditions on the planets. Now, I've kind of focused on Mars over the years because there's more information available to us about Mars than there is available to us about Venus. But what's interesting is that there have been more missions to Venus than there have been to Mars, but less information.
No, that's true, too.
So I focus on Mars, and when you look at Mars, you can take their own evidence, take NASA's own evidence, and prove that their public statements about the conditions on Mars don't match the evidence.
Well, that's true. Dr. Jastrow, that was part of the Viking mission in the 1970s, made a very definitive statement that NASA had a skeleton in its closet, and already then they had detected positive signs of what you would call microbial life. And that, and immediately, when we talked about the pictures from the face on Mars, and immediately when those pictures came out, the NASA Viking was due to land near the plateau of Cydonia, and immediately the mission status was changed to a completely other location. And so, it's not viable to say that everybody involved with the space agency is part of this massive cover-up. As we know, there's no possibility of keeping leaks from coming out. We know from WikiLeaks and many other things that eventually information drifts out.
Okay, we have to step away for a break, and we'll pick up right there when we come back. So don't go away, folks. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is none other than Glenn Steckling from the George Adamski Foundation. Glenn, you were talking about how information leaks out, and
that's
we had
correct.
To go to break.
It leaks out. And remember that you are, up till recently, you are susceptible to only one source of information. And I don't think there's too many people out there in this day and age who feels that any official agency, when it has a monopoly on the information and is chartered to investigate itself and these types of concepts, gives the vote of confidence to take that information as it's being presented. You mentioned earlier Mars missions and the instrumentation, and I was going to say that the information you receive is only as good as the calibration of those instruments. So all those people who are telemetrically downstream of the information, is collecting and deciphering that data, but they have only that data to go by. So I give you an example. In 2002, the instrumentation that was used in the Viking mission was taken down to the South Chilean desert, what's called the Atacama Desert, and they ran the experimentations, and based upon the same instrumentation that was sent on Viking, this instrument said that there was no life on this planet that we live on based upon the readings it took in the Chilean desert. So what I ask people to think of is that not all these people and all these scientists and all these computer specialists and everything, they wouldn't be possibly involved in a blatant cover-up, but they have no idea what the calibration changes that have been made to the instrumentation may be. And if that is changed by 200 or 300%, then what you get is a 200-300% variation. For instance, the Russians originally recorded that there was something like 800 degrees in Venus, and we said it was 400. Well, that's 100% error. We measured the trace elements on Mars and said that it was 0.03% argon, and it was 30%. That's 1,000% error. So we have to justifiably question these type of reports. And in fact, here just last month, it said here in the Discovery News that Viking found organics on Mars, and the experiment now in, once again, Atacama Desert in Chile verifies that. So we get bits and pieces of information that is constantly given to you by a sliver, like a tiny piece of pie, and then it's hoped that you've eaten that piece of pie and you're going to forget about it, because in 20, 25 years, they're going to refeed you another piece of that very same pie that they put in the freezer, hoping that a new generation has come and the older generation has forgotten or become disassociated with it, and then you're given the information again. It's never progressive. It's just recycled. In 71, Apollo 12 and 14 reported water geysers on the moon for 14 hours. Well, there's water on the moon, 14 hours worth spraying out of the surface in 71. And then in the early 90s, they say, I think we found water again. And then in the 2000s, they said, yep, definitely water. We got polar ice caps. And so you're refed the same information, hoping that you're not going to ask for the next step.
Well, I do not disagree at all with what you just said, but I would add to it that I think NASA has knowingly lied on occasion. And I'll give you an example. NASA is publishing on their website today that the atmospheric pressure on Mars is something like 0.7% at the surface, 0.7% of what we have here at the surface. So that's less than 1% of the atmospheric pressure. Now, I know that you're familiar with flying. I'm familiar with flying. If the atmosphere is that thin, it would not be possible to create enough lift to fly an airplane on Mars with any type of conventional propulsion, unless you used rocket engines.
It would be very difficult to also calculate descent ratios and sustainable parachute size in order to get something on the surface.
Well, that's exactly right. Now, here's a very interesting, absolutely provable fact, okay? First of all, they say that the gravity on Mars is something like 50% of what we have here on Earth. That's a rough figure.
Okay.
All right. So if we take a 747 to Mars and try to fly it, all of the ratios have got to be reduced by 50%. But if you reduce the atmospheric pressure all the way down to less than 1%, you could not get lift. And here is NASA running a program to build and had a plan to fly. They budgeted it, they scheduled it, and then later canceled it. But to fly a remote-controlled, rather large remote-controlled aircraft with wings and a push prop on Mars.
Well, there you go. Do the facts match the supposition? As we discussed earlier as well, that the atmospheric pressure, actually they report more pressure on the moon, because when they opened the Apollo hatch, I think they said it was 1.5 or 2% PSI, and you have to have equal pressure to open hatches. And then there's no discussion about atmospheric compressibility. As we know, when you go lower in sea level, the atmosphere compresses as inversely to going higher in sea level.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that Mars has immense canyons, far greater than the Grand Canyon. And if you start taking 2,000-3,000 feet in depth, then you have atmospheric compressibility. So no matter how you mismatch these numbers and how you convolute that, and the fact that we know that instrumentation has been as much as 100 to 1,000% in error, or perhaps, shall we say, the predetermined setting of this instrumentation has been that, then, once again, the facts don't support the intent or the plan.
Okay, now I've got a question for you.
You say, well, quickly here, unless you need to go to break.
No, go ahead.
NASA has misled the people. Remember, they are not chartered to bring this information forward. Basically, their charter is space exploration, and they are controlled by military, and they are budgeted by the government, which is constantly being cut. There's no public support, even though there's a 3-to-1 profit ratio, jobs ratio, for the space program. We do not invest in it because we just have no prioritizing in it. And so,
okay, I'm going to ask this question before we get very far away from what you said that prompted the question. All right, here's the deal. If the calibration is off on the instruments, as you said, by 100%, then you're going to get 100% error in whatever data you get.
Correct.
All right, so if NASA knows that the atmospheric pressure at the surface on Mars is a great deal more than what they're telling.
For instance, say they don't know, and the people who construct these probes, which are overseen by other agencies outside NASA, can adjust this calibration and ship them the finished product, and then they put it on the rocket and send it. So remember, like in layers to an onion, there are many more reasons and variables to every situation that we talk about in this field.
I understand. Now my question. If NASA knows, but they're giving the wrong information to the people that are building these satellites and science instruments, and they're calibrated based on the wrong information, then NASA would be guaranteeing that we're not going to find, if it's, for instance, the Levin experiment package from 1976 Viking lander, if it's calibrated based on erroneous information provided by NASA, then it's going to guarantee that it doesn't find what it's supposed to be finding.
Well, I think that there's the caveat that I mentioned to you before is that those agencies and those industrial complexes that build these probes are not beholden to NASA. They have other bosses. And they're the ones who determine what calibration differential goes in. So I think that NASA gets the information that they're given and not necessarily are in control of all the avenues that is being perpetrated in this field. And basically, these are accusations that cannot be totally substantiated because there are too many agencies and too many variables involved.
NASA sent a lander to the northern polar region of Mars. It was called the Phoenix. And NASA's been saying for all these years, and they're still saying it today, that the atmosphere is so thin on Mars that water cannot exist as a liquid. So whenever the polar ice begins to melt and evaporate, it doesn't go through a liquid state. It goes instantly into vapor. Mm-hmm. Well, the polar lander aimed its camera at the ground, and in the frame, in the picture, we see the leg and the foot pad of the lander. And in a series of photographs, you can line them up and play them like an animation. And you see water droplets forming on the leg and trickling down.
That's true. You can see the condensation. So that blows that theory out of the way.
Yeah.
Also, remember that every person who stands in front of a camera who is supposedly representing either a contract for NASA or so on and so forth are not always totally briefed. They're spokesmen. They are junior PR people. And so, once again, when you talk to the scientists that are directly involved, like we did with Viking, with Dr. J. Stroh, and let's face it, Carl Sagan had a few things, choice things to say as well during his career, but then you get a little bit of a different tone to it. I can tell you, my father was invited to go to NASA, Goddard Space Flight Center, before 22 scientists to show Adamski's film. The same year, he was invited by Colonel Freeman, and anybody who has any history, knowledge of this subject knows about Colonel Freeman in the late 50s, and he was in the Pentagon in 67, and Colonel Freeman invited my father to see the Adamski films and photographs, and there were candid discussions going on about how they fly, their propulsion systems, where they come from, who pilots them. So this was by no means a hidden a subject when it was internally discussed.
All right, we have to step away for a break. I want to pick up right there and want to talk about that, and want to bring up a sketch of some writing, a message that had been given to Adamski when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Glenn Steckling. He is the head of the George Adamski Foundation. And Glenn, when we went away for break, you had just mentioned about your father being called to NASA, and then also before what was the colonel's name?
Freeman.
I'm sorry, the colonel's name?
Yeah, Colonel Freeman.
Freeman.
Colonel Freeman at the Pentagon.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, and they all wanted to see the they wanted to see the George Adamski films of the craft flying, and you said that for sure they were very open in their discussion about it and very serious.
Absolutely, they knew how they worked, where they came from, and what was going on to a certain degree. Absolutely,
they knew where they came from.
Well, yes, absolutely. So so let us give credit where credit is due.
Well, I give them credit for knowing, but I don't give them any kudos for then lying to the public about it and ridiculing and making us think we're idiots.
Also, these particular two groups did not make official statements either to the pros or the cons. Mm-hmm. However, what they did do is they acquiesced to a meeting with outside individuals who were not under the same restrictions and secrecy acts that are made to be signed by these type of individuals, so that information could then go out through a different avenue. It doesn't make any difference which avenue is being used, as long as the truth is being promoted. So if we're sitting around, and I say this all the time because I see there is an immense misconception, well, there are multiple misconceptions in this field, but one of them is this. One, that people expect that there's going to be this beautiful revelation of all the truth that is going to be put on this nice, beautiful silver platter and made palatable to everybody's opinions and ideas and concepts, whether they agree with it or not. That's never going to happen. And it cannot happen, because even if they would give us the truth as they know it, this information has become so convoluted and so fought over and has become such a witch's stew internally that it will be denied simply from the fact of being, well, they've lied to us before, why would they give us the truth now, so this can't be the truth. And so we go back and forth with this constant argumentation phase. We get nowhere. It's called sensationalism or bashing. And I have to tell you the truth, psychologically, if you constantly bash somebody, you're going to expect them to turn around and say, oh, thank you, you're my friend, and I'm now going to give you everything you want. That doesn't work that way. If somebody constantly beats you up on the air, you're not going to be happy about it either. So my father.
Well, yeah, but that's a two-way street. That's a two-way street. People weren't bashing the government until the government started pulling all kinds of nasty, dirty tricks on the people relative to this. It's a two-way street. They've been bashing the people, ridiculing people, harassing people, and ruining careers. They have many crimes to answer for if they ever do disclose.
And who is they?
They would be...
Are you going to hold the people who did that during those decades individually responsible?
I think you have to.
Well, they're dead now.
Not all of them. It's still going on.
A few of them that are still around. I remember there's one of them, one congressman at the time in 1968 in the Senate Subspace Committee hearings of where McDonald was, and everybody, Professor McDonald from Arizona, and multiple scientists in order to get this out, and he made a statement that that the public does not have the right to know, and he later became your Secretary of Defense not too long ago, not this administration, but the previous. So, yeah, there's a certain attitude involved. Many of them are gone. There might be a few trickle few left. But I think that we're getting away from the subject, because what we're doing is we're constantly looking from who to blame, who to accuse, who to point the finger at. And we become so involved in doing that that we're not spending any time uncovering what needs to be uncovered, what the truth needs to be exposed, to be the vehicle and the avenues to give people more information. Because they can't get it from there, then we have a responsibility based upon whatever experiences we have. And also to make a comment here, nobody's an expert and nobody's an authority, and it's certainly not me. I just have some extra information that I was privileged to learn and live. But we have that responsibility to present the very best we can and not constantly point fingers at everybody. This is going nowhere, and anybody who's lived through the last 40 years of this subject has seen that this type of activity has gone nowhere. It's doing the same thing today it did 20, 30 years ago.
Well, and I agree, but I would say this. We can't ignore that part of the story either, because part of the story is the interference being run by the government even today, and there are people still carrying on what I'll term it black ops against citizens. While you can't focus on it, you can't forget it.
Well, of course not. They did that 50 years ago, and they did it against George, and George laughed at them. They came up to his residence, and he gave his information freely to the government and the military, and several of the gentlemen in black showed up and said, if you don't shut up, we'll tie you to the bumper and drag you down the mountain until there's nothing left of you. And he said, okay, thank you very much, very much. And the next day he made a phone call to the district supervisor and says, I know the names of your agents. I know the names of the organization. And if you don't watch out, it will be publicized in every nationwide magazine and newspaper and expose you all for who you are. And they left him alone from that day. So you can either fight the system and get nowhere, or you can do some good work and get somewhere.
Well, I agree with that. But there you have George fighting the system. Shining light always makes cockroaches run. And that's important. Look, he was given a message, and we're going to have to move on to this because we're going to be running out of time here. We've got a break coming up. He was given a message, and I want to ask about it. Now, our TV audience is seeing the message. It's a bunch of symbols. There's sort of a football-shaped American, for my international audience, the American-style football, shaped like a rugby ball. Kind of that shape is also there at the top. And there are symbols within that rugby ball-shaped object. One of the symbols that we see there in the center, very prominently, is what we would call a swastika. This symbol appears in all kinds of ancient manuscripts. When I used to live out in Arizona, we'd go out to South Mountain and look at the ancient petroglyphs carved into the rocks, and there are swastikas there. There are people who report seeing UFOs that have a swastika on the bottom of the UFO. Now, you've had a lot of time to look at this message and to study this message. Has anything been deciphered out of this message, and is there any understanding of why that swastika is there?
First of all, as you mentioned, what you call a swastika is basically a misrepresentation because the symbol is not the same. There are two crisscrossing S's basically going with the turning points the other direction. If we go into ancient societies, this symbol is in China, in South Pacific, in Africa, everywhere. And basically, it represents the four cosmic forces, earth, fire, water, and air. And it's a universal symbol, and basically, we have... due to our historics of recent events, we have misrepresented that symbol to mean something entirely else. So we can't blame the source for that. Secondly, these symbols are representative, and there are many different symbols, and they're on multitudes of different types of crafts which signify from where they come from, and it has nothing to do with manufacturing here on this planet, which has been promoted by some people as being these being Nazi crafts. And as far as the deciphering of that message, yes, it is the translation was given, and in order to sustain a certain amount of not secrecy, but a certain amount of oversight or authority there, the only part of that message which was given publicly out was the fact that there's a sentence that says here that George is our contact on your world, and we support him 100%. And the reason that the rest of that message is not given out, because there has been a multitude of individuals who have, in fact, one recently, whose editors contacted me and said, well, you know, we have written and published that this letter and message means that. And I said, absolutely hogwash. It has nothing to do with that. And then they said, well, can you give me the translation? And I said, do you think I'm stupid? And then you're going to publish that alteration and say that your people were responsible for the deciphering of it. So we have to be cautious in how this material is misused. Before we go to break, I do have something that I do want to mention as well that's been on my mind, and I think it's an appropriate time to discuss it.
You have 6 seconds.
2 minutes worth.
You have 6 seconds.
Well, that's not going to be enough, so I'll wait for the next opportunity.
We'll be back, folks, right after this, so don't go away. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Glenn Steckling. He is the head of the George Adamski Foundation. George Adamski is in our recent past, but George Adamski was one of the early contactees in the modern UFO era to come forward and talk about his contact with people from another planet. And it's absolutely fascinating to hear some of the details. Now, I want to welcome those of you who have just now joined us in this second hour. Welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here. My sincere sympathy to you for whatever it is that kept you away from the first hour. But we're glad you're here now. In just a little bit, I will open up the telephone line so you can join us and provide your questions, your comments, and we will invite you to do that in just a few moments. For now, let's go back to the telephone with our guest. And Glenn, there was something you wanted to get into that we didn't have time before the break.
Yeah, very quickly, because we're talking about George, and like you mentioned, there's a great deal of information, internet and publication and otherwise. There's a great deal of misinformation in books and materials, some of them recent. There's a lot of discontinuity and a lot of misunderstanding that has been promoted from people who didn't know the man or had no contact or association with him. And that basically many points of view have been expressed, and to the greater extent they're simply that, just points of view or opinions, and everybody's got those, and we all know the old saying about that.
Mm-hmm.
And so to clarify things, they said that George had, there were two Georges, one that came from one from the 50s and his contacts, and one that were later in his life, and I can categorically say there were never two Georges. What happened is people have made these statements due to their expectations of the man. And what has happened is when people have certain expectations and everybody's different, then they promote those expectations to that person and then become severely disappointed when they're not met. And so that's been some of the misunderstanding. But George, due to his contacts in the early 50s. Remember, we had come out of World War I and World War II, and it was hoped that we had exhausted ourselves out of destruction and aggression and millions upon millions of lives being lost, and there was finally an opportunity for a new thought, for a move towards concepts and principles encompassing greater individual thinking, greater individual expression, and what we would call a global potential. And it was hoped that this would evolve into much more unity and much more combined progress, where we didn't leave sections of populations and ethnicity behind. However, George was the consummate realist. He was not a dreamer. He was not an imaginator. He was a realist. And he understood that this work would take great personal effort and courage, and these new thoughts would be resisted. There was a very large element of resistance, and that was to grow stronger and bolder with each successive decade. So what happened is George realized there was a system in place, one that did not embrace these changes and that would fight them tenaciously, and that a wise person learns through recognition and realism that to make changes, you have to live in the here and now, and not just dream about what could be or to dwell in this never-never land.
Mm-hmm.
He believed a certain way of life would be beneficial to all humanity, and this is basically what his space contacts came. Not to give it to us, not to force us into it, but by example to show us what is possible, and hopefully when we see what's possible, we want to emulate that betterment of life. However, he also was wise enough to understand the ills of the current society. So while later in life, he was very much attuned to showing people and telling people how the changes had occurred. And he went about teaching those awarenesses. And so he taught both the positive and the negative, the good and the bad, so we have to understand it. And whenever there's a social crisis, there is those who promote this futuristic state of nirvana, a state of mind or thought that will magically appear in order to release us of our stress, and that is much of the metaphysical group. However, when there's a global reality of poverty and hunger and inequality and injustice that exists every day to day, then this imaginary state of mind and thinking does not substitute for the necessary actions in order to create a better way of life. And George was uniquely aware of that. And so he taught people that you have to go through the classroom of life to understand its many aspects. You cannot jump classes, you cannot jump levels, because each level in the classroom of life gives you the awareness and understanding to go to the next level. And there's no magical global nirvana that's going to descend upon it and make everything better, because that would deny us the natural principle of our own evolution of thought. And I think this is especially important because I see this misconception promoted all the time in this field.
I agree 100% with that. One of the sources of frustration for me with this field, speaking of ufology, is this idea that, for instance, that all extraterrestrials are wonderful, benevolent, spiritual beings.
True. That's a misconception.
Now, look, just because they have advanced technology doesn't mean that they are advanced spiritually. And one of the things that I've said on this show is, look, just compare us to the day the Wright brothers flew at Kitty Hawk. In a very short time, we have become very advanced technologically compared to then. Did we become more spiritual just because our technology advanced? Apparently
George
not.
George used to say we're technological giants and we are sociological morons.
Well, there you go. There you go. All right, I want to invite the audience to participate in the show. And, folks, we do that by telephone because it is a talk show. All right, the telephones are open, and the telephone number, the main number here in the studio, is 623-444-5889. The toll-free number in the USA and Canada is 888-223-4599. If you don't need to use the toll-free number, please call the main number. But if you need to, it's there. Now, if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, in other words, you're not in the USA and you're not in Canada, we still want to hear from you. We want you to participate in the show. You can call our main number, 623-444-5889. Or, if you don't want to make the international long-distance call, I don't have a toll-free number for you. But I do have a flash message option on my website. So you just go to my website, scroll down, you'll see the picture about tonight's show. On the right side of that, you'll see a link that says flash message, all right? And you can send your question or comments that way. I will read them on the air, and provided they pertain to tonight's show. And then we'll ask our guests to answer or comment on them. So the telephone lines are open, 623-444-5889. Glenn, I showed a picture earlier, but we didn't talk about it, and I want to talk about it. There is a picture of George standing in front of a sketch that apparently he drew, or maybe he commissioned to an artist to have it drawn. But it's a picture of what a person from Venus looks like, and he's standing in front of that. Can you tell us a little bit about that picture?
Yeah, there were two artist renditions that were commissioned. One of them was the sketch, and the other one is about a 5.5-foot-tall painting that hangs in my office of the gentleman that he met in Desert Center and consequently thereafter. And basically, it's a fellow that's about 5'5", 5'6", with a light olive, a Mediterranean complexion. In this particular circumstance, he had blondish hair. In other circumstances, he met individuals with different color hair and different color eyes, both men and women. They were entirely human, like you and I. And in fact, if we go to the quotes of Gordon Cooper, astronaut Cooper, on the Merv Griffin Show, he said he encountered many of these types of individuals in his space travel, and they look just like you and I. So these individuals can walk amongst us, and we would not know, and if they certainly wish to do us harm, they could have done it thousands of years ago, and they never have.
Now, I find this picture very interesting, but it's made more interesting by a sort of a dust-up that happened in 1954. 1954, it's August, there's a UFO conference or congress being held at Mount Palomar. And at this conference, three individuals walked up. Adamski is one of the three main people putting this conference together. But there were three individuals that walked up into the crowd and created quite a stir, according to reports. And one of the reasons, especially the female, one of the reasons was she had black eyes. And someone snapped a photograph at the time of this person. And the report is, now, this may be totally bogus, but I want to ask you about it, okay? I want to know if it's accurate. The report that's out there on the internet is that people in the crowd asked them if they were from Venus because they had a very striking appearance. She answered that they were not from Venus. People in the crowd asked, is what George Adamski says true? Do these UFOs, these spaceships, come from Venus? And she said they are from Venus. What's interesting about this is they did snap a picture of her. I don't have this. People can go on the internet and look. But I don't have a blow-up, a zoom-in on her face and forehead, but she has a very odd structure to her forehead that you can see when you zoom in on it. What can you tell us about this story? Her name, the name that she gave, I believe, was Dolores Barrios, but nobody seems to have been able to find any further information other than what she claimed. She claimed she was a clothing designer.
Well, I can only tell you what my experience, or our experience rather, has been with George and amongst these people. First of all, they're extremely cautious. They do not divulge their identity because it's extremely dangerous, life-threateningly dangerous to do so. So you will not find any affirmation in the direct question answered. As far as physically looking, they don't look any different than you and I. There is no physical attribute that makes them stand out from anybody else other than the sheer joy of knowledge, living, and enlightenment that resides within their eyes. And that is something that you experience when you interact with them. So as far as what that incident is concerned, I was not there, and I cannot give you any affirmation of that other to know that they will not acknowledge where they come from in a public forum. They will never promote that, and those who do so are not where they say they come from. And
well, see, and that's consistent with what Dolores said. She said, "No, we're not Venusians."
Right, and it is, well, remember that was a specific question from one specific location. but there are more than one group of people coming from different planets,
mm-hmm.
right? So just because they didn't come from Venus, so to speak, didn't mean that they didn't come from another one in our solar system. So they didn't technically lie to you. They just answered the question that they were asked.
There you go.
They didn't ask them if they were extraterrestrial. That's a different question, isn't it?
It is.
And then once again, I will tell you this, that when George traveled, and he traveled arduously, all over the world.
Let me say to the listener that's online, just hang on, we'll get to you in just a moment. All right, go ahead.
When George traveled, he was always accompanied. He never, never went alone, because the people who supported him know that under these duressful and stressful conditions, you need all the support and affirmation that you can possibly get. So they gave it to him.
When you say he didn't travel alone, are you saying that this was someone from Venus who traveled with him?
I will say that he was always accompanied by friends of his.
That sounds rather cryptic.
No, it doesn't. It tells you exactly it. It tells you that he was accompanied by friends of his who were his contact. Mm-hmm. And they not necessarily came from one planet. They came from many different ones.
Ah, got you. Okay, caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and from where are you calling?
My name is John. Hello?
Yes?
We're waiting to hear you, John.
I'm from Desert Center, California, actually.
Uh-huh.
And Glenn and I have communicated recently on a couple of issues. I just thought it was an interesting point I'd like to make. If you were to ask, or if a poll were taken of people's opinions about life on other planets, other places in the universe, I believe you would find that the majority of Americans do believe that there is intelligent life other than our own in the universe. And so a couple of things I'm aware of, and I don't recall the specifics, but I believe there is a huge satellite dish somewhere, and it's actually built on the ground. And it is for the purpose of monitoring potential radio signals from space. Intelligent life somewhere out in space. And also, I believe it was one of the Voyagers that has now gone into what they call deep space that carries a message to other civilizations should one happen to encounter that capsule. And so the government does have those two programs I'm aware of that are efforts to either communicate with or receive signals from other civilizations in the universe. So as far as the concept goes, it's certainly not anything unusual. In fact, I believe that most Americans consider that there is intelligent life elsewhere. Now, the other point here, if you want to go then to the case of UFOs, what that really means is an unidentified flying object. Now, I'd related to Glenn a couple of instances, and I won't repeat them right now, of individuals here at Desert Center who had unusual experiences. And sure, some of these UFOs turn out to have perfectly normal, what we would call normal explanations. For example, a weather balloon.
Okay, you're going to need to get to the point because you're running out of time.
That don't. Go ahead, please.
That's correct, John. Thank you for the call. Of course, Desert Center is where George had his meeting there, November 20th of 1952. John, you're absolutely correct. A poll was taken, and it's a worldwide poll. And of course, as we progress scientifically, and we have this vast plethora of media and science fiction and what have you, the concept of extraterrestrial life is well recognized, at least from the standpoint that there has to be intelligence in the cosmos far greater than ours. Every time we look in Hubble, and we look in the deepness of space, that we never found anything before. Now we found trillions of more galaxies and planets, and never ending. And so the difference is, in the 50s, when we took the poll, people were willing to interact, and they asked them, if one of these lands, are you willing to interact peacefully? And the answer was yes. And when that same poll was taken in the 70s, the exact reversal has happened, where we're either going to get our guns, shoot them, or fight them, or whatever. And there's very specific reasons for that that we need to go into, and I don't know if we have time to. Secondly, the telescope that you mentioned, Arecibo telescope, the radio telescope, is in Puerto Rico. It's been there for, I believe, since 1968, and is a in-ground dish that looks for radio signals in space. And I have an article and a report that talks about the fact that we have received signals from space at a regular pulse rate, and it has been recognized that it is much too constant to be anything else than some type of communication. And the last thing, you're absolutely right. UFO means unidentified. And presently, in this day and age, about 50% of what we see as so-called UFOs are not extraterrestrial craft. They are terrestrial craft. They are craft that are designed, manufactured, and piloted by various agencies on and organizations, military organizations, research and development on this planet. If we see anything that's triangular or has appendages hanging from it, that is not coming from outside this planet. This is coming from here, because the propulsion system to go interplanetary does not allow, constitute the ability to hang things off of it. It would tear it off. Next, there's a certain amount of misidentification going on. As you may have mentioned, weather balloons, stars coming over the horizon, the magnification of the lower section of the horizon through the density of the atmosphere. And these are all parts and contributed to it. So probably today, as far as my information is concerned, about 20% of actual so-called unidentified flying object sightings have the probability of being crafts outside from this world. And so we need to avoid this rush to judgment, this convenient association and bandwagoning that's going on, to first make everything that is unidentified got to be coming from space. Secondly, it's going to come here to hurt us or threaten us or eat us or some other ridiculous nonsense. And so that's what I have such an issue about this convoluted field about. And I will remind both Kevin and the listeners that when George lectured, he was very adamant against the so-called psychics and metaphysical people who would abuse this subject in this program in order to promote their particular way of thinking. And he was so concentrated about it that one of these people, a woman, stood up in his lecture and said to him in front of everybody who came from these organizations, "If I had a gun, I would shoot you dead right now." So his opposition metamorphosized from what we would call a government standpoint, as they recognized him more and more, and became much more the opposing forces in this field who would like to use this subject as a launching platform for their way of thinking and their agenda.
All right. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hello, Brent.
Glenn, Kevin said this a lot. We've heard it a lot. It's just the fact that they have that technology does not guarantee that they are spiritually evolved. Now, I'm going to ask for your input with the reference from George. What, in your opinion, is the role of those who look like us, act like us, and interact and are on this planet? Are they protecting us, or what are they doing here?
They have come amongst us for thousands of years, and they consider us to be like brothers and sisters and extended family, very much like we have over time, through our religious organizations, created missions in which we go to very different areas of the world and hopefully help the indigenous peoples or the populations, hopefully don't subvert them into our way of thinking. But
all right, we'll have to get the rest of that answer when we come back. We'll be back, folks, after this break, so don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Glenn Steckling, and he is the director of the George Adamski Foundation. The telephone number is 623-444-5889. Toll free in the USA and Canada, 888-223-4599. And if you're outside of the USA and outside of Canada, you can call the main number or use our flash message option on the website. Just go to kevinsmithshow.com and scroll down. You'll see the link beside the picture about tonight's show. You'll see where it says flash message. All right. Very quickly, Glenn, you were... I had to cut you off as you were answering Brent's question about the people that walk among us who are from other planets.
Right. So let me quickly finish on that idea. They come amongst us to both be, by to exemplify something that which we may notice and may be wished to emulate. In other words, they live by example and hoping that by doing so, that we will follow that example as well. They perpetuate no mysteries. They do not go for that at all. They are the ones who want to give us and show us natural explanations and to show and direct us that many of the explanations and advancements we seek surround us with a nature right here on this world. We have all the same opportunities and all the same elements for development that they do. We just simply do not always recognize them. So they do not come amongst us to give us more mystery to tantalize our minds. They don't work that way. And lastly, due to a certain amount of science fiction, we have come accustomed to so-called warp speed Scotty, that you can just point yourself into space, go at any speed you want, and we don't truly understand that there are immense storms, electromagnetic storms, like massive hurricanes in space. There, everything is in motion. There are shifting of the elements and planets and so much activity going into space that it requires a technology many thousands of years ahead of us to be perfected. And so we need to give them credit where credit is due. And lastly, we talked about the disparity about sociologically development or spiritual development and scientific development. We have that problem here on this world because we choose it. And we manifest it, and we use it as a divisive tool to separate each other where they do not. And in order to travel the distances of space, you also have to congruently develop sociologically, intellectually, and spiritually as well. So when we see, like we talked about before, facts that don't meet, then we have to also look in this thing, because the space people are being accused of many different things and associated to many things falsely that they have absolutely nothing to do with. We dissect people. We manipulate genes. We artificially inseminate. Isn't it amazing that all the attributes that we currently exercise surprisingly have been projected upon them? And I say nonsense.
Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Rusty from Michigan.
Okay, Rusty, I'm going to ask you to speak up for us.
All right, is that better?
That's better.
All right. Hi, Glenn.
Hello, my Rusty.
Hello. Do any of these aliens, whatever, are they, like, we always hear the thing that some of them may be controlling some of the governments around the world? You think that's true?
I think that we do not have inadvertent control. We have willing participation. Nobody can make you do anything you don't want unless you willingly participate in it. And that's an entirely different ball of wax, isn't it?
Yes. And how about during a disaster? Have they or do they or will they help during a disaster? Such as the 2012 thing coming up?
They have helped us from our own stupidity many different times. To my knowledge, they have helped directly to avert two nuclear catastrophes. And as we know from many different reports, they have disarmed missiles, disarmed facilities, and it has been of great concentration to many of our military experts to do that. And they are reminded of that every so often, that they are not the big shots they think they are. And secondly, there are natural cycles that occur on this planet, and global warming is truly a misnomer. It should be rather called geophysical change. These geophysical change happen cyclic. Are we directly responsible? No. Do we contribute to it? Absolutely. Because the more we throw the natural balance of things out of balance, the harder the consequential reaction is. And so when you have earthquakes and you have tidal waves and things like that, they come here to educate us how we can determine through instrumentation when that's going to happen and where that's going to happen. And to my knowledge, we have successfully done so. So if we have these so-called natural disasters, it is because that we fail to educate the public on what's happening and what's going on. If we live on an earthquake zone, then we can't be surprised if there's earthquakes.
Yes. And one more question. We hear about, like, telekinesis, or about, like, how some aliens can talk back and forth to place thoughts in people's minds. Are they doing that through technology such as very advanced computers, or are they physically able to do?
Well, actually, we're pretty adept at doing that ourselves. We've experimented with vibratory controls, frequency wavelengths and things like that, on how we can cause certain events to occur, exasperate people either aggressively or make them fearful or make them uncomfortable, imbalanced, and we have experimented among our own people concerning that. To tell you the truth, they really don't need to do any of this stuff, right? I mean, let's face it. They're living on planets and in different places with a better way of life than ours. And what's the value of traveling all this distance in order to just play games? I think we give them a great discredit by putting these type of associations to them. None of them that I'm aware of do that. Now, as we mentioned before, are there benevolent ones? Yes. Are there not so benevolent ones? True. But there is a basis that comes about with the ability to deep space travel, as I mentioned before, sociologically and intellectually, and they're not stupid. They know the law of cause and effect, or as we said in old days, what you put in motion, you will be responsible for. And they're not stupid. They're not going to come here and cause you harm, because ultimately that natural law will bounce back to them. And this is, once again, ignorance on the part of people in this field who promote that.
But Rusty's question was not that. His question was, when they communicate with people telepathically, are they using technology to do that, or do they have that natural ability to do it?
That's a natural development, and sorry for that tangent there. Telepathy is your natural ability. All of nature uses it around you. Your dog or cat uses it with you, and sometimes you're not even aware. When it wants to eat, it sends you the picture. It's a picture message process. George wrote three very good pamphlets called The Telepathy Course, Part 1, 2, and 3, in which he explains that. It's available through us if you wish it. It's very nicely written and very simplistic to understand.
Very good. We have a flash message from Ramon in Puerto Rico. It's very short and to the point. He says, Why don't we have heard more about Mr. Adamski?
Well, actually, George Adamski, contrary to many of the other UFO personalities over the many decades, is one of the most consistent survivors. His 8mm movie film remains the greatest demand for UFO documentaries. Over the years, my father already, since the 70s, made section of those films available, and recently I made sections of the film available through high-definition transfer to 20th Century Fox, and they are incorporated in the re-release, the digital re-release of the original 1951 movie, The Day the Earth Stood Still. There's a section towards the end called A Brief History of Flying Saucers, and you will see a multiple interview section with myself and many other people, and then you will see sections of George Adamski's film in there. And they have been nothing but shown to be authentic. No one with any technical background or facts or evidence, other than innuendo and supposition and opinion, they have never come up with any concrete evidence to make those films and pictures fake. And in fact, if you go on our website on the George Adamski page, you will find a plethora of supportive information over the years that were given towards those evidence.
Yeah, that was one of the things that on your website that the very first time I visited your website, it caught my attention, were the statements by people who have examined either film, movie film, or photographs shot by George Adamski, and these are people with technical expertise in evaluating such film. And one after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other, says there's no evidence of hoax here.
That's correct. This is affidavit from the laboratory that handled the original negatives, Pev Marley that worked for the Hollywood film studios made a statement, and others have made a statement. There's no way that you can fake the graying effect of a telescopic shot, which all of George's pictures have. Remember, the strength of George's material is that it existed long before computer manipulation programs. These days, you can contrive anything, anywhere you want.
Well, that's true. I read Jim Delatoso's comments with interest because he goes into detail about, you know, this could not even, it couldn't be a small model being held up in front of the camera. And he goes into all of that about the lighting differences between small objects and large objects and the graying effect and difference around the edges of the objects and so forth. And and he speaks
of... That's absolutely correct. And including to that, I mean, Leonard Cramp, Space Gravity and Flying Saucers, did orthographic projections between GA's pictures, as we call George, and the Coniston photos in England, and also with the South American photos, all taken in different places, same type of craft, different conditions, and by doing various measurements, the orthographic projection, they found a consistent size. And then the Hollywood studios released a statement that by examination, or JTEC's model actually, that's on our website, the letter from the fellow from JTEC's model says that through examination, he found the craft to be about 33 feet in diameter, which is exactly what George said it was, the initial small craft. And so, and this is why, as you mentioned before, detractors and skeptics and the constant bashing of GA is basically always the same old lines said over and over again, that it was a water cooler or a hen feeder and blah, 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 and each one of those have been proven otherwise. But those who wish to convolute and distort this field are constantly bouncing those old accusations around because really they don't have anything of their own to say.
We have a flash message from Lewis in Australia, and he wants to know if the George Adamski films are available for purchase, and if so, where?
I do not make the films themselves are in archives, in the vaults, as the original films, in order to maintain restoration as much as possible. The best thing I can say is you can order it online, the high definition re-release of the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, not the new one, which starred Keanu Reeves, but the original one, which is the 1951. And you can find it online, and then go to the tail section under A Brief History of Flying Saucers, and you will see several multiple clips of the UFOs that George Adamski took. And in fact, when I went to that studio to do the transfer, I went into a room with a huge television screen with a multiple, like an accordion, controls and everything. And as they transferred that film onto that screen, boy, the technician sat up with his hair on the back of his neck and said, "Oh my God, am I seeing what I'm seeing?"
All right, we have to step away for a break, and we shall return. Don't go away. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. We are on Final Approach, ladies and gentlemen. That means we don't have a great deal of time left here this evening. And we are talking with Glenn Steckling from the George Adamski Foundation. Glenn, I've got a very quick question from Dan in Croatia. On the flash messages, he wants to know if Adamski books are available in either the Croatian or Serbian language.
Not to my knowledge. About a decade ago, I was approached by a gentleman, I believe, in Serbia, who wanted to make my father's book, Alien Bases on the Moon, available. And we started the process, and, you know, due to the difficulties of living and the political situation, I think that has gone away. They can find the books through Amazon.com, or they can find it on the Adamski Foundation website. And right now, I have it available in English, some in German, some in Spanish, but mostly all in English because of the immense costs involved to handle the material in multiple languages.
Are you or the Adamski Foundation, would you be open to if somebody wanted to translate the book, would you be open to talking with them about that?
Absolutely. I maintain an open door policy. I try to do everything. As far as my work is concerned, I donate everything that I do and the times and the fees. The only thing that I do as far as publications is make sure that I cover my costs in order to make that available. And so absolutely, and I've been approached by people. In fact, one fine gentleman in Portugal, in Lisbon, translated telepathy and cosmic philosophy into Portuguese, and I have that on disk available. Quickly, the other person you mentioned in Australia in 2006, I lectured in Brisbane at the UFO Bureau, and there's a local-made DVD of that. If they contact them in Brisbane, they'll have that available, and if they don't, I have it available for them as well. For the other gentleman who mentioned why did they come to visit us, I think George's third book, Flying Saucers Farewell, which also came back out in years later in the paperback Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery, contains much relevant and pertinent information that was produced in 61. George's fourth manuscript that detailed exactly what was going on in this world was never published and remains in the vault to this day. And so we will reproduce Flying Saucers Farewell. I've been working on it for a number of years to put in archival photos and updates to it, and I hope to make that book available at the end of this year.
You have an upcoming meeting with someone that listens to this show from time to time, and that is Neil Gould over in Hong Kong. What's that meeting about?
Well, yes, I have the opportunity sometimes to travel the world quite extensively, and I get a number of emails and requests. And in this circumstance, Neil and I communicated a couple times, and I told him I was coming to town and if he wanted to have lunch. So we'll sit down and have a nice little discussion and exchange ideas. And there's another gentleman in Paris in France who has asked me to come over and talk to several groups and perhaps partake in a conference that will occur next year. And so as time and profession and expense permits, I give it everything I've got.
So you've never met Neil previously?
No, I have not.
I have had some communication with him. He is, folks, Neil is sort of the head, I guess you could say, or a moving force, moving factor in Exopolitics Hong Kong. And you can see some of his videos on YouTube, and I encourage you to do so. They've done some very good video work. So this will be your first meeting. I think knowing what little bit I know about Neil, I think it will be, for both of you, a very profitable meeting.
Well, absolutely. Well, we won't say that it's enlightening, because it's always good to talk to people. And mind you, like we say, that it's good to have people who don't agree, because then we talk intelligently and communicate well. And so the world is full of experiences, and it's our best to make the very best out of them.
What do you think if George Adamski, looking upon the wide expanse of the current state of ufology today, what do you think if he could step up to the microphone tonight and tell us something we need to hear, what would he say?
Well, I knew what he expressed in the last several years of his life, what he expressed in some of his unpublished writings. To make it very simple, he would say, people, start telling the truth. and that applies to everybody.
At one part of tonight's show, I stuck a pin in the secret keepers, both at NASA and involved in various agencies of the government, which they deserve. But the fact is, and I stuck that pin in them for not giving us straight information, but for being deceptive. But the fact is, we have people within the ranks of ufology who do not work for the government and are not paid disinformers, but who are spreading just as much disinformation. How do you deal with that?
Well, it's not my... I try to stay level-headed and concentrated with the subject and the experiences and the resources that I know. And let's just say that it is wise to measure the amount of information or knowledge that one puts forth. You know, everything is has to be done in stages and the levels of understanding that you deal with people. And I think, like any other field, we are dealing with the human mind, and the mind has so many different facets of expression. There is a great deal of self-motivation, self-recognition, self-promotion, the need to be recognized, the need to be someone, and these type of minds express themselves in every field. And so there's no difference between that and this particular field. However, I think that people need to recognize that you need to be responsible for what you say. You just can't shoot things out to the people and say, well, hell with them. If they take it wrong, that's their problem. We have a responsibility as educators, and we have a responsibility as media people or whoever that deals with the public to be the most concise and factual and neutral as possible. And that doesn't exist too much anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, like I said before, what you set in motion, you become responsible for. And when you think about that, then you better make sure you know what the heck you're talking about and what you're doing. Because I wouldn't want to pay that price.
That, I think, is those are very wise words. I know of several, but two come to mind right now. People that are out there making a name for themselves, and that's truly what they're up to. They've appeared on my show. They've appeared on other shows, and they are as fraudulent a pair as I have ever met.
Well, Kevin, remember that you can only, like you said before, you can only lie for so long. You can only deceive for so long. And over the last 45 years, I cannot count how many of these personalities have came and disappeared into the dust.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. Glenn, I want to thank you for being my guest this evening. We are up against the end of the show, and if you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment as I bring tonight's flight in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. That's a wrap for this evening. George Adamski, you need to check it out if you haven't. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too. You can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Why? Because you have a right to know. Until next time, so long, everybody.